It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for being with us here on the Ideas Network. A major freight carrier shut down earlier this week, leaving more than 30,000 workers without jobs. Coming up, a former long-haul truck driver gives us an inside look into the massive, yet often invisible, world of trucking. First, staffing shortages are an issue every day in senior living facilities in Wisconsin. And according to Wisconsin Watch, conditions at some have become neglectful and even dangerous. And that is one of the many reasons our guest says aging now is more difficult than it needs to be. We want to hear from you as we think about aging. You can call 800-642-1234. Share the challenges you've faced as you've been getting older, or perhaps your quality of life has improved. Let's talk about what it means to age in our society now, because we're also talking about our failure to support our elders and the people who care for them. We'll look at how we might improve the system and how we can also embrace the many joys of aging with our guest, Marie-Therese Connolly. She's a leading national expert on elder justice, and she wrote the new book called The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. MT, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Keely.
Your book opens up in northern Wisconsin. It's a story about your mother-in-law's birthday. Tell us about that. How does it relate to the central theme of your book?
Well, thanks for that. Yeah, I grew up in Minnesota, but we had a cabin in northern Wisconsin, and we were taking a canoe and kayak ride on the Brule River, on the Brule from, you know, that empties out into Lake Superior, on my mother-in-law's 88th birthday. And she was this really extraordinary human being. Her name was Janet. And we were stopping by a little island in the river, and my kids leaned over and picked some flowers and gave her a little wildflower crown. And we all sang happy birthday. And then she made a funny face. And we said, "So, you know, why are you making the funny face?" And she said, "Well, for a second, I thought you were going to leave me on this little island. I know it sounds crazy, but for a minute I thought it was true." And so I was really struck by that moment, because in this like very loving time and day where she was having fun and we were all having fun and we were together in the, you know, the natural beauty of northern Wisconsin, she suddenly was worried. And so that made me sort of think about aging and how some older people really worry about being abandoned in their lives. So that, you know, and it seemed like a good place to open the book, because there are a lot of challenges in aging, and there's also a lot to look forward to and a lot of beauties. And we sometimes miss out, we sometimes are unprepared and underestimate both of those.
I imagine you did nothing to make her think that you would just leave her there. And yet it really surfaced a real fear when it comes to isolation or being left behind. What role do you see that playing when we think about aging?
Well, as your question implies, isolation and loneliness are a huge epidemic among older people these days, and it's really very damaging for older people. You know, people 85 and older are the fastest growing part of population of the U.S. In the U.S. right now, and that is really amazing and wonderful. We get to live longer lives, and we have more time on the planet, but our lifespans are often longer than our health spans. So the average life expectancy is about 78. The average healthy life expectancy is about 66 years. And so a lot of older adults have some kind of functional disability. That means that a lot of people are going to need care. And we don't really have very good care systems in place right now. You know, Medicare doesn't cover long-term care. Most private health plans don't cover long-term care. And so a lot of families are really very much on their own, which is one of the reasons that we have more than 40 million informal or unpaid caregivers in the United States right now who don't get much help.
needing care, being in those sort of senior living facilities can physically isolate you. It can also emotionally isolate you from people. And then we have the added layer that you just touched on, the chronic staffing issues, the difficulty with finding reliable workers and being able to pay them well. Certainly that's an issue here in Wisconsin. Is that an issue everywhere?
It's an issue in many, many places. Direct care worker shortages, both in facilities as well as in homes. And it's, I think there are probably many different reasons to point to, but historically we have not treated direct care workers very well, and we haven't paid them well. We haven't provided paths for advancement, for good supervision, for helping care workers feel like we value the care they're providing and that we value the people for whom they provide care. So I think part of it is that, and we could do a lot better at that.
Are there tangible things that you could offer in this conversation to do a lot better? Or is this really something that we need to look at more, that we need to collaborate on more to figure out how we're going to fix that?
Well, I think it's both things. I think there's a lot more we can do, and we do need to collaborate more to find better solutions too, because aging is, I've come to think of it as aging is not just an aging problem. Aging is an issue for all generations, and our policy failures cascade into all the generations. And so we really need to start getting ahead of that. So some of the things that we can do is to provide better caregiver support so that caregivers who are providing care for loved ones at home don't feel so alone. So they feel like they have resources or respite or education. You know, for example, dementia is a really complicated illness to care for. And we just expect that people somehow know how to do that. And a lot of people don't. And so we really need to support caregivers better. We also need to do better in terms of our stewardship over public funds. So, for example, nursing homes and what are called CCRCs, or continuing care retirement communities, they get over $100 billion a year in taxpayer dollars. And yet we don't know how they're spending those dollars and how many of those dollars actually go to caring for residents and to the benefit of residents. And sometimes we don't even know who owns the facilities who are getting those dollars. So I think just exercising better stewardship and requiring better accountability as a condition for getting those funds would go a long way, because we're already pouring billions and billions of dollars into our long-term care system. We just need to make sure that we spend those dollars well. And one other thing, as you alluded to, is that we know that staffing is the most important element of quality care, whether it's at home or in facilities. And so we need to make sure that we have adequate staff.
We're talking with Elder Justice Advocate M.T. Connolly about how aging is hard and how we can make it even harder to handle with the systems that we've put in place or that we haven't. And we're welcoming your calls at 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We're wondering what your life is like right now. Have you had to put in place some opportunities to make sure that you are aging well? Maybe you're at an earlier stage of your life and you're looking ahead and starting to think about that already, because you know that that's inevitable as bodies grow older. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can join in that way and help us better understand how you're living well into the later years. MT, there are certainly individual challenges that we deal with when we're aging, and yet we have this broader culture that does influence the way we think about aging and death and value. How do you see our broader culture affecting the way we treat people who are getting older?
It's such a great question, Keely. So we live in a country that is really scared of aging, that is really anti-aging. We hear a lot more about anti-aging than we do about aging well. And I think we need to create a more pro-aging culture. And that's not a victimless crime in a sense. You know, we know from other kinds of bias that bias leads to dehumanizing the people against whom we feel bias. And we then, you know, it's sort of like a toxin that then seeps into our institutions and into ourselves. And yet we feel like it's okay to feel ageism because we're all just getting older. And so we kind of don't notice what the damage is, although a researcher at Yale did a study showing that people who held the most positive views of aging lived 7.5 years longer than people who held the most negative views. So I think one of the challenges is to really take on how we think about aging, you know, and try and get rid of the fear and the denial and the shame, because they don't do us any good. It's just useless negative feelings. And to really kind of turn that dial to more positive feelings about aging, because there's also really good evidence of health benefits if we can embrace a sense of purpose as we grow older, and of meaning, and of feeling connection and staying connected to the people that we care about.
We're talking with author M.T. Connelly about her new book about figuring out care and finances and purpose as we age. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What have you enjoyed about getting older? What's been difficult? What didn't you expect? Do you feel like people treat you differently? Share your story with us at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Join our conversation now here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking about the systems we have in place to support us as we age and whether they work or actually make the journey more difficult than it should be. Our guest is M.T. Connelly, who's written a book about this. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. M.T., to kind of pick up where you left off, I know in talking with people aging in my family, I've heard them say, well, I don't want to be a burden. And I'll say that's such a hard thing to hear because we value them so much, but it has to be much, much harder to feel like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, so often people feel like they're either failing at aging or failing at caring. And a lot of that actually goes back to our broken systems. If we had a more robust network of community supports and services, that then older people wouldn't feel as worried about being a burden on their families because they would feel like there was support out there for them and for their family, their caregiving family members. So I think it's like a warning sign or some kind of smoke that suggests that we look more closely at how we're supporting people and families through aging. Mm-hmm.
We have Carol in New Richmond who's ready to join our conversation. Hey, Carol.
Hi there.
Hi. What did you want us to hear from you today?
Well, from a nursing point of view, I've been a nurse for almost 43 years now, and I teach the CNA program, and many of the CNAs that I do teach are, and hopefully they're listening. You know, I think that it's just, first of all, it's such a great, whether you work in home care or in a facility, there's so many opportunities, and it's extremely rewarding career. And many of them do work with the elderly. Right now, the WIS Caregiver Program does offer free education, and it's, you know, it's a great deal. It's a great deal for facilities as well because they also get some finances when somebody signs up through them. So, you know, and I do, you know, your speaker is so interesting because there is a lot of services that are lacking, I think, as a community. There's so many things that we can do. And, you know, the more active that seniors can be, the longer they are able to take care of themselves. And that's the basis of our whole education that I teach, is to keep them as active and as independent as they can for as long as they can do things for themselves.
Carol, thank you so much for sharing that with us and also for all of the work that you've done over these years as a nurse. I just want to make sure you understand that we appreciate you. MT, that brings us to a point about joy. I heard Carol talk about people being able to live independently, to do things on their own. What do you see people enjoying or looking forward to enjoying later in life?
Well, you know, first I want to thank you too, Carol, for your 43 years of work and also for training the next generation of CNAs. It's incredibly important, and Wisconsin is fortunate to have you. In terms of joy, I have a colleague and friend named Ann Bastien, who teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, who started an organization called Time Slips that's really in the business of joy. And Ann pervades a technique called creative engagement, whether it's for older people who are living in facilities or at home, and really trying to evoke more joy from life. So, for example, one of the things that I wrote about in my book is a program or something that Anne created called Beautiful Questions, there are questions that have no right or wrong answers. And my niece, Charlotte, actually went into a nursing home. She was volunteering at a nursing home and used these questions to start conversations about creativity. Like, how does music make you feel? Or what is a place that calms you? It doesn't rely so much on memory, so that for people who have memory issues, they can still participate in these conversations. And it's a really profound technique. Actually, the doctor I wrote about, a woman named Laura Mosqueda, and I went on a road trip to Morgantown, Kentucky, to see a play that Anne produced in a nursing home, a play called Wendy's Neverland, based on the Peter Pan story. But in Anne's version of it, Wendy has grown up and grown old and is living in a nursing home. And the residents and the staff and artists were all the actors and the crew. And it was this expression of joy and generosity and beauty. And it was really a very moving thing to see. So I think one thing we do too often is to give up on old age as a time that we kind of ignore at best or fear. And we should embrace it as a time of potential expanded opportunity for creativity and storytelling, and really think about what matters most to us on our own and with the people we love in our later years.
Thank you for that. We've had Anne Bastien on Central Time before, and so we've linked our conversation with Anne on our website at WPR.org. So thank you for mentioning this work that's happening really close to home here for WPR. We're talking with MT Connolly about how aging is hard and how our systems can make that better or actually more challenging. She's an elder justice advocate. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. I wonder, MT, lots of people have lots of advice about aging, but what did you want to share that's a different take than what's already in front of us?
It's kind of a simple recipe, I think, but one that we too often miss, which is to really think about it, to be intentional about aging, and then to have the conversations, to think about what are going to be the challenges, whether it relates to care or money or really complicated balancing of autonomy and safety issues, and then how do we plan for it to be a time of life where we do things that matter to us, to have purposeful activity. And a lot of people find a lot of purpose in volunteering or in doing something that they've never done before. And then to make sure also that we have the conversations in our families, among friends, and then also to push policymakers and employers and other institutions to be having the conversations about aging. How do we make sure that we're preparing for the challenges and that we can take advantage of and don't miss out on the really good parts of it, because there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. And I think there are small things that we can do to really improve our odds of a better old age.
I want to talk briefly about elder justice, because you've done a lot of work in this area. And I think it's important when you talk about policymakers to help us understand how that form of social justice intersects with other areas like race or gender or sexuality. Put elder justice in some context for us.
Absolutely. It's a question with many parts, but I'll try and do it quickly. What we know is that other forms of injustice make aging harder. So, for example, people of color experience about twice as much elder financial exploitation. Low-income Latinos were victimized about four times as often in terms of all kinds of elder abuse. And so what we see is a compounding of inequities over the lifespan. And often the people who most need access to care have the least capacity to pay for it, because we don't really have a payer system. We don't have a long-term care insurance system per se, except for Medicaid. So we really need to do much better at that and start having those kinds of conversations as well. Now, having privilege or resources is not a silver bullet. It doesn't protect you from some of the challenges of aging, but it is certainly much more, there are many more challenges for people of color and for people without resources.
It's certainly very complicated and so many things connected. MT, thank you so much for joining us today and for writing this book.
I really appreciate your having me, and thanks for the conversation, Keely.
Marie-Therese Connolly is a nationally recognized expert on elder justice, and we talked with MT about her new book. It's called The Measure of Our Age, Navigating Care, Safety, Money, and Meaning Later in Life. Coming after the news, the Yellow Trucking Company shut down earlier this week, and that's reinvigorating a conversation about the industry. We've got a labor organizer and former long-haul trucker joining us ahead. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Wisconsin was a tipping point state in the last two presidential elections, and we're likely to be one again in 2024. We talk about what a tipping point state is and why it's so crucial to presidential elections ahead here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Nashville-based trucking company Yellow abruptly shut down operations earlier this week and is headed for a bankruptcy filing. This comes after years of financial problems, which is according to a recent report from the Congressional Oversight Commission. The shutdown means more than 30,000 people are suddenly out of work. And labor organizers say that this mass layoff points to broader issues that truckers face. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know been affected by the Yellow shutdown? Maybe you're a truck driver, or you used to be, or you want to be. What are the biggest issues you see facing people in that job? You can join in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ann Bailey is a writer, activist, and labor organizer. She's a former long-haul truck driver and author of the book Semi-Queer, Inside the World of Gay, Trans, and Black Truck Drivers. She's our guest now. Ann, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yellow was one of the largest trucking companies in the country. Put this into some context for us. How does it fit into the larger matrix of the trucking industry?
Well, most truck drivers drive for mega carriers such as Yellow. So they are independent contractors or employed by these mega carriers, and they don't own the truck. They drive the freight that the company tells them to and are paid by the mile. in order to deliver the freight that we get everywhere. Yellow is one of the, you know, maybe 10 huge mega carriers that dominate the freight industry.
And Yellow was a less than truckload carrier. What does that mean?
LTL is the type of freight where you're not delivering the entire content of your trailer. So in a semi-truck, that's a tractor trailer. The tractor is the part with the engine that you, you know, sit in. And then it attaches via a fifth wheel to a trailer. And in LTL, what's in the trailer is split between deliveries. So you don't take the whole trailer to a place, which is called drop and hook, taking the trailer to one place and leaving it to be unloaded later. Instead, you take it to a place, some of it is unloaded, and then you take it to another place and some of it is unloaded. So it's just sort of, if you have enough stuff but not enough stuff to fill the entire trailer, then you hire someone who does LTL freight delivery.
If we nationwide don't have as many LTL, less than truckload carriers, what ripple effects could you see coming from this?
Well, truckers deliver everything that we eat, wear, do every single day, right? So if there are less LTL carriers than usual, there could be shortages of any of the things that we expect just to sort of automatically appear on store shelves. And one of the things that truckers care about is that we, the general public, notice and think about how stuff gets there and, you know, depriving all of these people of their jobs also deprives us of the convenience of having stuff just easily and automatically where we expect it to be.
In Wisconsin, sometimes we have that conversation about food and farms or like milk coming from not the store, but from actual dairy farms. And you're saying, yeah, but to get from the dairy farm to the store, it's probably going on a truck.
Right. Yeah. When I was a semi driver, I was with a company based out of Appleton, Wisconsin, Rail Trucking. And we frequently delivered to, Meijer or Menards or any of these. So, you know, it starts at a farm, but then it needs to be put on a truck and taken to a distribution center or a warehouse or a big box store. And then that's how we get it.
Yeah. And we don't always see that. Ann Bailey is a writer and an activist and a labor organizer, also an author and a former long haul truck driver. And we're taking your calls about trucking here on the Ideas Network. You can use the number 800-642-1234. And we've got John in Oconomowoc ready to talk with us. Hey, John. We actually lost John. So, John, if you want to give us a call back, that's great. Or if you have experiences related to Yellow or beyond that when it comes to trucking, or you have a question about the trucking industry, we might be able to tackle it now. The number again is 800-642-1234. And the Teamsters Union, which represents Yellow's 22,000 unionized workers, said that the news about Yellow shutting down was unfortunate but not surprising. Who are the Teamsters? They're mentioned all over these articles. Help us understand their role in trucking.
Well, the Teamsters was traditionally the union that dominated trucking and still, as you said, organized Yellow, but very little truck driving work is now organized by any union. So it used to be about 85% of truck drivers were in a union, and now about 18% are in a union. So the Teamsters was hoping that the Yellow contract and the UPS contract, both were up right around now, would signal a shift in organizing freight movement. And maybe that happened with UPS. I haven't seen the contract because it isn't voted yet. But with Yellow, it didn't. With Yellow, as you know, instead of getting a decent contract, the company declared bankruptcy and just fired everyone. So that's not what you hope for from a union. And as a union organizer now, I can say that in an industry with 18% coverage, a union can't do a lot. I mean, I would love to blame the Teamsters, but it's really hard to compete with unorganized workers who bottom in terms of freight shipment charges. So truck drivers don't make hardly any money compared to what they used to. It used to be a route to middle class life, and now it's a very much less pay for the amount of work that you do. And with fewer and fewer trucking companies unionized, that becomes even more true. And it's hard, that small a percent, you know, 18%, to make a difference in the industry. So trucking as a job pays less than it did before, and very few workers are in unions.
You mentioned early on, too, the idea of being paid by the mile. What happens when your truck is broken down or you're stuck in a traffic jam if you're paid by the mile?
You don't get paid, right? So there are very few industries in the U.S. now that are piecework pay models. So, you know, it used to be standard. Like, think about Victorian seamstresses being paid per, you know, lace collar or whatever. And that was made illegal, and instead we got an hourly wage, right, minimum wage. But the Department of Labor does not control either trucking or firm. Those are both controlled by other companies.
And I'm going to go ahead and jump in here. I'd love to get back to the rest of your question, but we are having some trouble hearing you. So we're going to make sure that our connection is solid here. And I'll go ahead and remind our listeners that now is a time that they can be part of this conversation. We can call 800-642-1234 if you'd like to join us on the phone. We've also posted this story to the Ideas Network Facebook page, so you're able to weigh in on that. And also, you can email ideas at WPR.org. We can go ahead and talk to Steve in Johnson Creek now. Hey, Steve, what did you want to share as we're talking about trucking?
I quit counting after 40 years of trucking. I started in the 70s. I actually started driving before I even had a driver's license, which don't tell the DOT. But my concern with call is that the safety people in cars aren't really told the safety around semi-trucks. They, granted, everybody tells them how unsafe they are and all this other kind of stuff, but it's
All right, Steve, I think we're having some connection problems to you, too. But Steve brings up the issue of safety when it comes to driving trucks. And Ann Bailey, I think we've got our connection sorted out. What do you see when you're thinking about safety and truck drivers?
Truck driving is a really dangerous job. It's one of the most dangerous jobs there is. And the government wants us to believe that regulations are to encourage safety, but that isn't, in fact, the situation. There are so many regulations now directed at drivers rather than at companies that the job becomes increasingly unsafe. If you look at crash statistics for truckers, you can see they go up every year, even as the government clamps down with more and more regulations. So the regulations are about managing workers, not about safety. But the caller is right that four-wheeler people, people who drive regular vehicles, don't consider the safety of truckers the way that they should. Like, we should be taught how to drive around trucks so that the trucker is protected at least to the extent that is possible out on the road. And that's not currently the situation. Like, never pull into the gap that truckers leave in front of them on the highway. They left that on purpose so they can stop. It takes a long time to stop. And frequently, you know, vehicles see that and rush into it, and that puts them and the trucker at risk.
I wonder, is it just the size difference, the physical difference, where people figure, well, they're in a big tractor and I'm in a car, they must inherently be safer? Or where do you think that comes from when you say that people driving those four-wheeled vehicles don't think about trucker safety?
Well, I mean, trucking is a stigmatized job. And truckers are considered, in many cases, just not valuable. So there isn't a system in place that values and respects what truckers do or have. So, you know this because truck stops and truck parking are being reduced, and nobody wants truck parking to open in their neighborhood. They want it to be somewhere else, anywhere else. And that's because there's a feeling that truckers are disreputable, unclean. There isn't a sense that we all depend on their labor all the time, and we should make choices that value and respect them. And so that's part of it, right? But also, even though they're big, trucks don't have airbags. There isn't anything technical in the truck that keeps the driver safe. So just being aware of that is important as well.
Ann Bailey is a labor organizer with the Service Employees International Union. We're talking about the state of trucking, the working conditions for drivers, and that's especially in the wake of trucking company Yellow ceasing operations earlier this week. Lines are open. You can give us a call and join this conversation at 800-642-1234. We just heard Ann tell us the assumptions about truckers that we know aren't true. Next up, we'll get into what truck drivers really look like and the lives they really lead. This conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with author and labor organizer Ann Bailey about the state of the trucking industry. And Ann, you wrote a book. That book is called Semi-Queer: Inside the World of Gay, Trans, and Black Truck Drivers. So tell us, who are the people that are driving trucks across our country?
That's a rapidly changing question. So people's stereotype is that a trucker is a white man, maybe middle-aged, maybe overweight. This is not true. It was true at one point when trucking paid well and offered independence and some degree of respect. But as the industry changes, those people flee it in search of other jobs that they can get. And the people who flood the industry are women, queer people, trans women, immigrants, people of color, all the people who have trouble getting more traditional or more respected jobs. And that change is fairly dramatic in the trucking industry. So if you go to any truck stop anywhere and look around, you won't see, you know, the trucker that you saw in 1970s movies about trucking. You'll see a whole mix of all kinds of people out there. It's great.
You serve on the Women of Trucking Advisory Board. What's it like for women in this profession?
There aren't very many women. There are no statistics on how many trans people drive trucks. So that's complicated and something we need to change. But it's a dangerous job for women. That's true of any male-dominated industry. It's challenging. The industry doesn't make it easy. At the same time, the women who do it absolutely love it. They love the freedom. They love movement. They love being able to shape their own lives and jobs. I mean, I met so many women who consider it like the answer to everything, that they get to do trucking. And, you know, they hate it when I emphasize the dangers. They want me also to emphasize the adventure and the excitement of it.
Well, I do have to ask, what are those dangers?
Oh, rape is really common. Almost every woman I've met who drives truck has been raped or attempted raped. It's very common. And in training fleets, the model is set up to, if not encourage, at least permit people who've been accused of rape, and in some cases convicted of rape, to continue to train new drivers, which means they're locked in a cab with each other for 6 weeks or so, with one person in complete power over the other in terms of job security. So there are problems. It's not.
Thank you for detailing that for us. Ann Bailey's an activist, a labor organizer, a writer, also a former long-haul truck driver. And we're taking your calls here on the Ideas Network. And we've got Judith in Solon Springs who'd like to join this conversation. Hi, Judith.
Hi, thank you. My husband drove long-haul trucking for 10 years, and I used to go with him on occasion. And it was very interesting to go into cities and towns where they really did not want the truckers in town. And many times we were actually told, get in and get out as fast as you can. because they don't like you here. And it would just kind of surprise me, because where did they think they were getting their supplies from and their products and their whatever? It's the truckers that are bringing them in. But also, I was always astounded by how the average driver on the road doesn't understand that that truck is carrying thousands of pounds of weight and can't stop and can't maneuver like a car can. And the risks that drivers of cars would take just blew me away. And in fact, one time, my husband, I wasn't with him this time, but he was driving and somebody was following him too close. And when he stopped, they stopped quickly and actually went down under his back bumper and got caught on his bumper, and he was dragging that car. And he didn't know that, because when you have that great big trailer behind you and all that weight, he had no clue that he was dragging that car behind him until another trucker, this was back in the day of CBs, and another trucker got him online and said, you need to pull over because you're pulling a car stuck on your bumper behind you.
Wow. Judith, thank you so much for sharing that with us as a really incredible demonstration of what we're talking about when it comes to safety. We want to go to Neil in Minnesota now, too, who's also wanting to join the conversation about safety. Hey, Neil.
Hi, good afternoon. Great conversation, great topic, you know, but I do want to, I think it's important to stress that there are safe truck drivers and there are truck drivers out there that probably could be driving safer. Same with the average public. I work in the transportation industry. I used to drive semi years ago. I don't anymore, but I still work on the highways, and I see it every day from both the truck drivers and the traveling public. From driving too fast or too too fast for conditions, tailgating, driving too close. That's something that everybody can have a part to improve on. One of the things that they've changed over the last couple of years, and I think it was February of 21 or 22, I can't remember, but they changed the CDL training requirements. You know, it used to be that you could go out and take a written test for a permit, jump in your buddy's semi and practice, and then go down, and if you were good enough, pass a written test. That's no longer the case. You have to go through an accredited training program, which is great. I think there's a lot of people out there that probably took some shortcuts getting their license. I think that's coming to an end. But there's still room for improvement. Health cards, for instance, a commercial operator has to every 2 years go and get a health card, go to see a doctor, make sure that they're fit. You know, there's a lot of organizations out there, a lot of government agencies that are exempt from those health cards, yet they're driving the same equipment, the same heavy 80,000-pound, 60,000-pound vehicle.
Yeah, Neil, thank you so much. I want to make sure that Ann has a chance to respond, because, Ann, we've got a lot of focus here on safety. And in this last bit of time we have with you, I wanted to know what remains. What do you need to get across to people about safety for truck drivers and alongside them?
If truckers were paid more, they could drive in a safer manner, right? So when we talked about construction or by the mile pay, what that doesn't acknowledge is, in order to support yourself, you need to drive under conditions that maybe you wouldn't choose to if you were emphasizing only your safety. And you have to in order to make enough money to support yourself. So if you don't make money when it's snowing or if there's traffic or an accident, in order to, come clean at the end of the day, you have to keep going when you might be tired. And that just means all we have to do as a country is pay attention, value truckers as professional workers, and pay more so that you're not put under this pressure because of the wage structure to keep driving when you probably shouldn't. Because you're right, caller, that most truckers are safe drivers who really want to do a good job and have no desire to die at work, but are often put under really intense pressure to keep driving when they shouldn't. Hmm.
And this has been a really informative conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Ann Bailey, former long-haul truck driver herself. She's currently an organizer with the Service Employees International Union. She wrote the book Semi-Queer: Inside the World of Gay, Trans, and Black Truck Drivers, and joined us for a closer look at what's going on in the trucking industry after major freight company Yellow ceased operations earlier this week. Coming up here on the Ideas Network, tomorrow on The Morning Show, we're strategizing on staycations. Not everyone has the money or even the time to travel around the world for vacation, so join us to hear from a travel coach and a psychology professor. We'll talk about how to make the most of a staycation. That's tomorrow morning on The Morning Show. I have a kid who loves pretty much anything that lives in the ocean, but she is particularly interested in big creatures and creatures that lived a long time ago. Really, when she turned 7, she asked for a megalodon birthday cake. She's beaming in those photos of my very crude representation of the largest extinct shark to ever live. R.I.P. So she's really going to love this news out of Peru, where scientists have discovered what could be not just the heaviest whale ever, but the heaviest animal in the known history of the world. This whale could have weighed as much as 35 school buses. That's more than twice the weight of today's blue whales. A team has spent years unearthing the whale fossil from a rocky desert slope. Now we have 13 vertebrae from its backbone, 4 ribs, and a hip bone. And that's enough to make a real case that the Perutusus colossus was the heaviest animal ever. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.